little bit of a language lesson, and maybe Juan can help me with this, maybe Matt Floresta and others, some of my family, Brian Foster too could help me with this, but pé de fruta, what am I talking about? What kind of tree? Fruit tree. April's got it. April doesn't even need Portuguese. Let's give her a hand. That's right. Fruta. But the interesting thing, the reason João kind of hesitated a little bit is because when we say fruit trees in Portuguese, you say pé or foot de fruta, foot of tree. And so that's just how what they're called. Fruit trees are called pé de fruta. But why do I say that? We lived on Avenida Príncipe de Monte Verde for several years, about 6 to 7 years in the south part of São Paulo. That means Green Mountain Prince Avenue, if I did the sequence right. But we were in this little area that had a lot of trees. That was extremely rare in the concrete jungle of São Paulo because you just did not see much greenery at all unless it was like the big park in the center, you know, close to the center of the city, Parque Ibirapuera or something else. You just did not see many trees, but God was very gracious, allowed us to move into this little neighborhood. It was off of one of the reservoirs, and our area of the city went between two of the main reservoirs that really provided water for most of the 20-plus million people in the city. So in that area, you had some pockets with some greenery, and if you went even further out, it was protected land, even though things still happen, invasions still happen of property, but you did have more green space, and occasionally you would have something called chácaras. And chácaras would be these smaller areas of land, but that had greenery, had pé de frutas or fruit trees. Usually they were owned by people that had maybe an apartment in downtown São Paulo, and they worked in the city, but then would come out to these, you know, plots of land and these chácaras or these little, I don't want to say retreat areas because they're not really retreat centers, but just think that there's a little bit more land than anybody else had. That was the idea. Right down the street from us, there was a family that lived on a property like this, a little chácara. It was real close to the reservoir. And occasionally he would bring different fruits down to us and share with us. But the interesting thing was that area, that house and land did not belong to him. He was a caseiro, another part of your Portuguese. So help me out, Brian, João. Conservator. April, she's like, man, I'm on a roll. Let me try it again. I mean, maybe I'll get this right. Perfect. So he did not own it. He wasn't the owner. He and his wife and little daughter, they weren't owners of that. But there was a little house set aside for them that they lived on the property. The main house was for the owner who would come in from São Paulo on the weekend sometimes or maybe on vacation and spend more time there. But as the manager, as the steward, then he would take care of all these pé de frutas, all these fruit trees, and he would cut the grass, and he would keep up the house and do some of the maintenance, and he would share with us as neighbors some of the fruit because the owner wasn't there all the time and couldn't eat all that fruit. But there were limitations. He didn't throw big parties for all of his friends to come. He would help with maybe parties that his owner wanted to throw, but he didn't throw big parties on the land because it did not belong to him. He was a steward of what was being put under his care for the owner to come and enjoy. You and I are stewards. We are just to take care of the gifts that God gives us. And we see this here in 1 Peter chapter 4. James 1 even says, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. So God gives us a lot of gifts. We're going to see some of those gifts this morning. We're called then, and we're responsible to manage those gifts well, to be a good steward of God's grace. Let's look at verse 7 of 1 Peter 4, how we should be motivated by God's game plan. Like, David, I don't see that in that verse. Well, it's not there. But I want you to see that, look at the verse, and it's interesting how it starts out. It's kind of a stark statement. The end of all things is at hand. Wow. Whew, how encouraging. The end is coming, doomsday. Well, no, not necessarily. We're going to see that that's not specifically what it's talking about. But the end of all things is at hand. As we look at this, I want to encourage you, especially as believers, to be motivated, to be encouraged by God's game plan. When I played years ago, when I played the football, and you're like, yeah, I know it was years ago. When I played football, obviously I'm not a big guy. I never was. I don't think I'll ever be a big guy. But I was fairly fast, and I ran scared because I didn't want people to tackle me, so I would run fast. But there were certain plays that the coach called that I loved, and then other plays that I hated. When he would say a halfback sweep, man, I got motivated because I knew I had a chance. If it's a halfback sweep, I'm going to get the ball and I can run around the side and I have a better chance of outrunning other people. But then if he said, if it's a blue 24, you're like, what is that? So blue 24, that was the left side. It was the two halfbacks. So me, the two halfback would run through the four hole. That means I had to run through the line of scrimmage. And I would run behind my fullback, Mark Limbaugh, but he was a pretty big guy, but he could not always open a hole for me. If Mark did not open a hole for me, you better believe I was not opening a hole anywhere because I was made a hole. I mean, I did not have the force to go through the line of scrimmage if somebody didn't open a hole for me. So I love the halfback sweep. And if the coach called that, I'm like, oh man, this is it. Here we go. As Christians, sometimes we see in Scripture some truths and we get motivated, we get excited, and then there's other truths we're like, God, that's your plan? I mean, really? So let's look at this. Jesus has set the stage, okay? The end of all things is at hand, we see in verse 7. What does it mean by that? Well, Jesus has set the stage. Now, 2,000 years have passed about since Peter wrote this, so you may begin to wonder, how is the end at hand? If this was written 2,000 years ago, here we go. Jesus has set the stage, 1 Peter 3 in verse 18. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. Notice, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. And then jump to verse 21, the latter part of verse 21, it says, through the resurrection of Christ. So what we have celebrated a lot in recent weeks, and hopefully you celebrate every day, but through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God with angels, authorities, and powers, having been subjected to him. While Jesus was on the cross, one of his last phrases, three words only. Anybody remember? At least three words in English. It is finished! It is finished. So in essence, Peter is reminding us here, yes, time may go on, but as believers, just as in Peter's day and just as today in 2024, we are to live with the expectancy of the return of Christ as he consummates his sovereign plan. He has done at the death, burial, and then resurrection, he completed every single thing that had to happen that would precede his return. So the end of all things is at hand. That means it's near. That means that we can pray and live as if it could happen today, and it could. I hope it does, honestly. Other than those that I'm still praying for their salvation, but so there's mixed emotions. But I do pray that Christ will come back soon. So we see that this has been talked about. Notice 1 Peter 1 and verse 5. Who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed when? In the last time. Then we go to verse 20 of chapter 1. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times for the sake of you. So God has been revealing his sovereign plan of redemption all the way from the fall of man, the first mention that Christ would bruise or crush or strike the head of Satan, and then all the way through. Galatians even says, when the fullness of time had come, Christ came. So we see that he came, but we are in the last time, meaning there's nothing else that has to happen. Christ can return at any moment. Jesus has set the stage, but notice Jesus is ready to judge. He is ready to judge. We saw this last week. But they will give account to him, 1 Peter 4 and verse 5. This was last week's passage. But they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. All right, I want to start off with the bad news or the sad news, and then we'll get to something more encouraging. Look, first of all, you'll see on the screen, Jesus is ready to judge unbelievers. Now, he has offered the gift of salvation. He's given himself to provide that gift. But for those who reject that, Jesus makes it very clear. There are consequences. You will be judged. Revelation makes this clear in Revelation 20 and verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. This is Jesus. From his presence, earth and sky fled away. No place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the book according to what they had done. Now, if you stop there, you almost might get the idea, all right, well, maybe I do need to do more good works than bad works. As we were looking Wednesday night, one of the principal ideas of Buddhism is that you have this thing of karma, and you've got good karma and bad karma. You need to do more good things than your bad things to try to break the cycle of life. That's not biblical. And we see here that it goes on. It doesn't stop at that phrase. Notice verse 15 of Revelation 20. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Jesus says, John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. So if someone has not accepted that path and followed that path of life through Christ alone, then their name will not be in the book of life. Jesus is ready to judge the unbelievers. Jesus is ready to judge you and I. Now, you may think, really? But I thought there was that verse somewhere in Romans that says there's no condemnation. That's true. So let's look at a little more explanation of that in 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 1. This is how one should regard us, Paul says, as servants of Christ, and notice the word, and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. Notice, it is who judges me? It is the Lord. So Paul's making a very important principle, stating a very important principle here, is that those of you at the Corinthian church, you're not my final judge. I am not even my final judge. It is the Lord who judges me. He goes on in verse 5. It says, therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness, and notice, and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Even our motivations are a part of this evaluation. But then this is an encouragement. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. Primarily, this judgment, this evaluation is about a gaining or a loss of rewards. There's no question if a true believer is going to go to heaven or hell. No, a true believer is an heir of the living hope we saw in 1 Peter chapter 1. It's incorruptible. No one can take that away. However, Jesus will evaluate. What are your purposes? How did you live for me? Will you receive rewards or will you have a loss of rewards on that judgment day? Jesus is ready to judge, and Jesus will return. Jesus will return. It's a fact. So because of that, in a little bit, Peter's going to say, therefore, because of this truth, there's some things that need to happen. 1 Peter 1 and verse 7. Let's rewind the tape a little bit and see kind of how he builds this truth. So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Therefore, preparing your minds for action, verse 13 says, and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Then 1 Peter 2:12, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. So what we're doing is we backed up from kind of chapter 1, and we're coming up to the passage that we're treating today. 1 Peter 4:13. Now we've jumped past verse 7, which we're going to look at here in chapter 4. We're going to jump past that and look at verse 13. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. Okay, now look again at 1 Peter 4 and verse 7. So we've seen several verses that lay the foundation, but again, verse chapter 4 and verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. What's the next word? Therefore, so because of this truth, there's some things that we are called to action. There's ways that we are to manage, to be good stewards of God's grace because of these truths. So what's going to be the advice? I mean, maybe this is going to be some radical advice. If the end of all things is near, then goodness, what is Peter going to tell us? Is he going to say, sell everything you have? Is he going to say that, you know, stay up for 24 hours and tell everybody about the gospel? The story is told, I don't know this is for sure or not, but the story is told that Martin Luther was asked one day, what would you do if you knew that Christ was going to return tonight? And he said this, I would pay my taxes and plant a tree. Basically, what he was saying is, I'm going to go about the life that God has given me, because really every day should be in light of that Christ could return. So it's not like Peter's not saying, okay, the end is at hand, so man, like this frenzied activity. Look at some of the advice that he gives us, because the end of all things is at hand. The return of Christ is near. You should manage well God's grace. First of all, we see in 1 Peter 4, 7, in the latter part of the verse, one of the gifts, one of the manifestations of God's grace is your communication with God, the opportunity that you have to talk freely with God, to go to Him in prayer. Remember, you may remember from a previous passage here in 1 Peter, it says that Jesus suffered and died and then rose again so that he might bring us to God. So this has already happened for those of us who are followers of Christ. And this is a gift that we have. Now, it's interesting. Last week, we saw some of the descriptions of those who follow the passions of the flesh. In these next few verses, we're going to see how we should manage God's grace well. And there's a stark contrast. So I'm going to try to point that out as we look at each section. So first of all, your communication with God. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. Now, the interesting thing in contrast, we're to be self-controlled and sober-minded in our prayers rather than in verse 3 of chapter 4, given to drunkenness. And we're to be sober-minded and controlled in our prayers rather than to be given to, in verse 2, human passions. So there's this big contrast. If we don't know the Lord, if we're not believers, then the natural tendency will be to just give ourselves to the desires of the flesh. Even as believers, the old nature is still present. And we can still choose to break our intimate fellowship with God. Not lose salvation, but break our intimate fellowship with God and follow some of the things in the past. Which Peter, you may remember in last week's passage, Peter says, the time is past to do as the Gentiles did and follow the human passions of the flesh. It's already, don't go back to that. You've done enough of that. It's not like you have to sin a little bit more. You know, I haven't sinned enough, so I'm going to sin just a little bit more. But your communication with God to be self-controlled and sober-minded. Because of what Christ has done already, there's this open door, the open access that we have to God. This is a gift that we have from Him. How do you manage that? Do you talk to God? Is this a natural part of your relationship with Him? Or is it only when things get really bad? Oh, man, God, I need you now. Yeah, and God's saying, you need me all the time. You need me all the time. Talk to me. Share your life with me. It's one of the beautiful things about the Psalms is the psalmist, sometimes they pour their heart out before God. Sometimes even in doubts that they have about God's goodness. But then usually at the end of the psalm, you see kind of full circle, and they come back and they say, but God is my refuge. God is my strong tower. God is my mercy. God leads me through. And so they don't shy away from saying, God, I don't understand. God, where are you? God, it seems as if the wicked are prospering. It seems as if everybody's against me. But then as they continue to meditate and talk to God, the Holy Spirit and God moves in our heart and reminds us, no, I'm your strong tower. You're in my shadow. I care for you. That's one of the gifts that we need to manage well. Are you growing in your intimate communication with Him? How often do you talk with God? Secondly, another thing we're to manage well is your interaction with God's family. One of the contrasts that we see is we're to keep loving one another earnestly. We'll read the whole verse in a minute. Rather than, verse 3, pursuing lawless idolatry. So instead of this chaotic type of living, this lawless idolatry, we see here in verse 8, no, keep loving one another earnestly. Instead of, you know, participating in orgies, this verse 3, it says, no, you're supposed to show hospitality in verse 9. These are the contrasts that we see as we're to manage well our interaction with God's family. So let's look at verse 8. Above all, meaning, listen, pay attention here. Understand the importance of this. Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Keep loving one another earnestly. This doesn't just happen. This is not a Hallmark or a Disney type of love. This is something that sometimes, and the idea even in the original word for this, in the original language for earnestly, is the idea of straining. An athletic or athlete straining his muscles for something, of earnestly, intentionally showing love, to love intentionally. 1 Peter 1:22 had already given us a similar principle. Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. Okay, as a good steward, as a manager of God's grace, what is one of the first calls? Well, love your brother in Christ. Love your sister in Christ. And sometimes we may not say it, but we think it, you know, man, I love God, I just don't like his family. I love God, but I just don't like that brother and that sister and this. No, we are to love earnestly, be intentional. And then it says that love covers a multitude of sins, the latter part of verse 8. I think the idea here is we see in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses. Sometimes you see this certainly in a secular aspect, where if someone is a fan of an athlete, of a politician, of a rock star, or whatever it is, in that person's mind, whoever they idolize can do no wrong. That anything they say, anything they do is just like, oh man, it's perfect because they're idolizing that person. In a biblical sense, the idea that a love covers a multitude of sins is that we are not easily offended. It doesn't mean that we okay and we say, hey, you're in sin? Okay, great. No, that's not the idea. And in growth groups, you're going to study some passages that show there's a responsibility that Christians have if you see a brother and a sister living in sin, caught in transgression, Galatians chapter 6 says. So that's not the idea. The passage is, hey, it's all about love. Don't judge me. But on the other hand, it means that we are not easily offended. Also in growth groups, you'll look at a passage in 1 Corinthians 13 that talks about sincere biblical love. What are some examples of that? How does that help us to love intentionally, love earnestly? Next thing we see is not just to love intentionally in a general way, but then Peter, he kind of begins to step on some toes. He says this, 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 9, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. So show hospitality joyfully. One thing that's important for us to remember, back in Peter's day, Were there Hiltons and Marriotts and Motel Sixes and the Jerusalem Airbnbs and the, Antioch vacation rental by owner? Were there any of those? So there were some places where you could pay to stay, but they weren't nearly as accessible. So oftentimes that meant, especially for those of the faith, those who were of the way of following Christ, they were called upon often to house and to open their homes to those that were the following through. And so Peter's reminding them, show hospitality. And don't just show it because you kind of have to. There's not many more options. But show it without grumbling. Do it joyfully. Do it with a happy heart. This is one of the ways that you're managing the gift of God's family well. That you've been placed in a family, that's a gift for you. But you need to manage it well. You need to steward. And one of the ways is you show hospitality with joy. Jesus showed hospitality to the disciples in John the Baptist. In John chapter 1, the disciples came. Two of his John the Baptist disciples came to him and began to ask him, where do you live? And Jesus says, well, come and see. And it says that they spent the day with Jesus. Now, where exactly did Jesus take them that day? Probably to somebody else's home, because we see that Jesus didn't have a regular address for 3 years of public ministry. But wherever he was staying, he told those two disciples, listen, come and see, come with me and spend the day. Jesus, you remember when after he was died, buried, and resurrected, Peter had denied him 3 times, and we won't go through the whole story, but remember what he did on the shore of the Sea of Galilee? Builds a fire, starts cooking some fish, says, hey, disciples, come and eat. It wasn't his home, he was just on a seashore, but he was showing hospitality. I want to care for you, I want to serve you, come and eat. Jesus received hospitality. We see in the New Testament, Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, that Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna, and then it says, many others that provided financially for Jesus. Mary and Martha hosted Jesus. Let's look at this verse. You'll see it on the screen in Luke 10, verse 38. Now, as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village. And a woman named Martha did what? Welcomed him into her house. I love that, because that's part of the expression of, okay, you're to love one another. Well, this is one of the ways of welcoming Jesus into her house. Verse 39 of Luke 10, and she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. Paul and his co-workers, Acts chapter 16, the Macedonian call, and they obeyed right away. They found this group of women who were praying, and then one of the women accepted Christ as her Savior. And then that woman, Lydia, did what? Anybody remember? Come to my house. She's a new convert. But God already worked in her heart and was just out of the joy that she expressed of what God was doing in her heart and who he had used to bring the message of salvation, she immediately says, hey, come into my home. In the same passage, Paul and Silas were later put into prison. Through a miraculous course of events, they were freed. Philippian jailer was very scared that everybody had fled. He was about to kill himself. Long story short, how do I be saved? They give him the message. Then what does the Philippian jailer do? Come to my house. Let's clean you up a little bit. Let's help you. Let's kind of dress your wounds again. Let's feed you. Again, a brand new convert. But yet God's doing a work in that new convert's heart and the Philippian jailer and Lydia and saying, come to our house. We want to show you the love of Christ. We want to show hospitality. We see in Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, this isn't just for Jesus. It's not just for Paul. But Romans 12, 1, it says, I appeal to you therefore, who's he talking to? Who does he address these next few verses to? Believers. Yeah, to believers, to brothers, to sisters in Christ. This is a call for everyone. It says, I appeal to you brothers, therefore brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Those are some pretty high terms. Living sacrifice, spiritual worship. So what is a part of that? What does spiritual worship look like? What does living sacrifice look like? Well, there's several things mentioned in that passage, but jump down to verse 9, Romans chapter 12 and verse 9, and we'll see a few of those examples. Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. I think this is interesting how this is phrased. Outdo one another in showing honor. Now, that's normally not our tendency. Normally, our tendency is, man, I wish people would appreciate me a little bit more. I don't think people have seen everything that I've done around here. And in fact, I think I might just go ahead and show them and tell them. But it says, no, outdo one another in showing honor and loving one another with brotherly affection. And then notice verse 13. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show what? Hospitality. To just be a channel of God's love in many different ways. It doesn't always mean having someone into your home. Remember Jesus on the seashore saying, hey, come and eat. I've made some fish for you. There's many different ways to show hospitality. But notice again, kind of a clarification or another qualification of how to do this. Verse 9 of 1 Peter chapter 4. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. Without grumbling. We have been immensely blessed through the years as we've stayed in home after home after home of people that many times we didn't meet until a few moments before they gave us their address and we showed up their house. We stayed at people's homes that we've never met and still haven't met because they were out of town and said, hey, there's some missionaries coming through. Here's the key. Here's the door code. They can stay in our house. And literally, it makes my mouth drop because I remember one home we stayed in, and I just thought, they don't even know us. And they just give us their garage code, and we come in with all of our kids and all of our stuff, and they tell us, open the fridge. I'm like, this is just the love of Christ. There's really nothing else to explain it by. We don't deserve this. But I want to share with you some of the most impactful moments of hospitality that we've received have been from some of the most simple families. As a teenager, actually, I wasn't even a teenager. I was probably in about fifth grade, accompanied my parents on a mission trip to Mexico. We drove a few hours across the border, and we were in a poor area of northern Mexico and helping a Bible Institute there. And during the day, chipping tar off the roof. They were trying to expand, and so we had to get the tar stuff off the roof to be able to build on top of that. And then in the evenings, we would do things with the church and church families. And we had about 25 people. And this family invited us to their home for a meal. I'm like, oh, wow, this will be neat. And the home was two rooms. And I can still vision this. As I walked in the first little walkway, and there's two beds. Parents, that was their bed, and then the kids slept on the bed right across this little walkway. There's just enough room to walk. And then there was like kind of a little closet, and then you would step right into their kitchen. And that was it. And then if you walked anymore, you're out of the house. The bathroom was outside. There was a hose over like this wood enclosure. That was the shower. But they were so excited to have prepared a meal for our entire group. And as a fifth grader, I still remember that occasion very vividly, because they didn't minister, they didn't show hospitality out of luxury, out of an abundance, but they showed hospitality out of an abundance of love in their heart. And it really helped me to understand this is what it's all about. Sometimes you think, man, you know what, we're still getting settled in. We'll do that later. Or we just don't really have the time to do that. Or we don't really have the finances to do that. This verse doesn't say anything about showing hospitality with a bunch of money. It doesn't say anything that you have to throw a big spread. It doesn't say anything about you have to have the nicest decorations. It says show hospitality The only qualification is without grumbling. That's it. All of us can do that. And all of us are called to do that. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. Why does he put that? Because there are so many blessings in receiving hospitality and showing hospitality, but there's also a lot of sacrifice. Patience is required. Humility is required. I'm just going to give you some, we're not any better than anybody else. All of you have experienced things like this, but we had a ministry team in our home on one occasion. And one of the men, by and large, the groups that we hosted blessed us more than we could ever imagine, just by their presence, their humility, their service. But this one occasion, there was one of the men who was, he was trying. He was hard to get along with. And I had this big glass mug that I like to put sweet tea in. So I had this big glass mug. Well, he found that glass mug and he claimed it as his for the whole week he was there. I'm like, okay, I'll give up my glass mug. It's no big deal. But not only that, he put the glass mug on the counter. And at the end of the night, you know, Kim was trying to clean up and the girls were helping. And sometimes we'd have church people that were helping, you know, prepare meals. And so took the glass mug and washed it or, you know, put it back. Well, the next morning, one of the next mornings, he got up. He says, where's my cup? Where's my glass? And Kim says, well, we washed it. And he said, don't move my glass. Do you know the self-control that it took for Kim to answer graciously to him? You know, I heard the slap come from the room. No, she didn't slap him, but it's like, the glass ain't yours no more, boy. So it wasn't his glass. It wasn't his home. I mean, but those moments, it's like, wow. Well, thank you too. We were kind of on the other side of that on one occasion. We went to a family's home, and they had been to Brazil a number of times. He was and still is, a cabinet maker, Virginia, phenomenal work, and one of the hardest workers I've seen in my life. I mean, we had to beg him sometimes to take breaks when he was in Brazil and helping because we were getting tired. We're like, Jerry, please, can we stop for a little while? But he worked so hard, and we were back in the States for a brief visit, able to go to their home in Danville, Virginia, outside of Lynchburg, and we stayed in their home, and Patty, his wife, had put the spread out for us for breakfast, and she said, you know, this morning we've got muffins and cereal and toast. There's some bananas here and strawberries, and there's some yogurt over here, and went through this whole spread. Michael was a toddler. I mean, he was really young, and after she went through the whole spread, he kind of blurts out, are there pancakes? And we wanted to crawl under the cabinets at that moment. We're like, Michael, look at everything that's been put out for us. Are there pancakes? So that's the difficulty sometimes is when you show hospitality, there's patience that has to be given and humility, and there's difficulty. And Peter says, show hospitality without grumbling. It's worth it. There's so many names that come to mind that God has just used immensely in our life. Nathan and Diane Frey, for about a year, every Sunday night after church, when we weren't understanding the language, we didn't know what went on most of the time during that day at church, we would go to their house, and they would feed us supper and share, kind of explain to us, well, this is what happened here, this is what happened here, this is what we're praying about. And they just showed hospitality to us again and again and again. Diane's in heaven right now. Nathan's still ministering and serving and opening his home, I'm sure, to other people, but they made a huge impact on us. Conceição, Sunday afternoon, going into their house. You want to give your girls a shower? You want to lay down? Here's lunch. I mean, just all the time. Another city that we served in, Lena, opened her home time and time again. And we have been greatly blessed. Families somewhat expected sometimes to show hospitality, but there's been moments where we really felt like, man, we're kind of pushing the envelope here. And was such an occasion several years ago, we came back and there were some family events that went down and some things that happened that we had to extend our stay for a couple months. And we stayed with Matt and Tina Ort, some of you know. Family of seven. And they have a family of five. 12 people in the house, 2 sisters in the kitchen, and thankfully they get along very well. But they showed us great hospitality without grumbling, and we were forever blessed. You know, preaching, I dedicate a lot of my life, a good portion of my life, of studying the Bible, getting ready to share with you what God's put on my heart. However, I don't think we need as so much more pulpits as we need more supper tables, coffee tables, pickleball courts, ice cream shops, dorm rooms, lab visits, for those of you who are doing research at KSU, where in each of those opportunities, in each of those ways, gospel-infused hospitality is being dished out. Preaching is extremely important, yes, but so much more happens outside of this room and outside of this building and away from what we call a pulpit and formal preaching. And oftentimes you will have such an open door as you share a meal, as you share a coffee, as you give someone a ride, as you help in different ways, as you're showing hospitality, the door will open to you to share the truths of the gospel in ways that may never be or won't certainly be as done as well here from the pulpit. Show hospitality without grumbling. We've seen some of the benefits of that even here recently in One Hope Church. How God has used some of you as you've opened your homes, if you've opened your cars, if you've given your time, and how God has used that in part to bring people to salvation and to be transformed. No, we're not a mega church, and that's okay. God, and we're going to see this here in a few minutes if we have time, but God has called our church and uniquely gifted our church to bless in ways that Peter reminds us, show hospitality. What an awesome opportunity in Metro Atlanta as people come through this city all the time. We have some, and I don't really even like to talk about it, honestly, but we have some who are finishing their undergraduate at KSU here in a few weeks. We're earnestly praying that if God has grace, that he will allow those students who we deeply love to stay here. But they may not. God may use them to leave Atlanta and go wherever God sends them. But I pray that while they were here, they will have experience in our homes and in our cars and the coffee shops and pickleball courts and wherever around Metro Atlanta, the type of biblical hospitality that Peter says, show hospitality without grumbling. Do this as a good manager, a good steward of God's grace. Lastly, I know we're not even going to start, but I do want to read at least the verses, and then we'll get to this next week. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 10 and 11. I want to read the passage at least, and maybe you can kind of soak on this the next week, and we'll look at it more specifically on Sunday. Verses 10 and 11. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks is one who speaks oracles of God. Whoever serves is one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. To him belong glory and dominion forever and ever. I want you to think this next week. You are gifted, Pastor. I know you are. It's a biblical truth. God has said that he has given you at least one spiritual gift. And you are uniquely gifted. How are you going to use that? How are you going to be a good steward of that? Think about it, pray about it this next week, and I pray that next Sunday as we look even dive deeper, that we'll be challenged to be good stewards of God's grace. So you bow your heads and close your eyes, I pray.